When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 25 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 25 An Agreeable Surprise. As they approached Mr. Raymond's land, Cecil thought he heard smothered laughter, low whisperings, and a shuffling of many feet. When he felt the floor of his hut under his feet, the bandage fell from his eyes, and he looked around without recognizing the place. The rough and naked walls were no longer to be seen. They were covered with pretty flowered paper, instead of the great square place without doors or windows or furniture. Now appeared a beautiful room, well closed, and in which nothing was wanting. At the right was an iron bedstead, furnished with a mattress, a bolster, and a coverlet. At the head of the bed was a pretty washstand, supplied with towels, and at the foot was a little cupboard, from which escaped a savory smell that proved this piece of furniture would not be the least useful in the room. Added to all these were two chairs and a wooden table. Cecil stood motionless for some minutes, doubting whether he was awake or dreaming. A burst of noisy and merry laughter and a mischievous pinch from Mary roused him from his stupefaction and convinced them that he was not dreaming, that the vision was all reality. He beheld assembled around him the masons, on the arm of whom leaned the blind man, and near them a group of young gentlemen, whom he did not immediately recognize, but in the midst of whom he noticed his patron, the printer. "Well, what do you say to all this?" asked Mr. Raymond's nephew, advancing towards him. "Do you not think that the 10 francs you gave to this blind man have been sufficiently profitable to you? Look, all the things here are yours. They are sent to you by these gentlemen themselves, who formed the patrol with whom you talked last night. The linen and the dishes were sent to you by their sisters. You will find that in the under part of the washstand, 2 pairs of sheets, 12 towels, and clothes for your use, for we happen to have brothers of your size. Here is a basket of fine peaches that you must eat with these brave men who built your house, and, as I have invited the blind man, his son, and his daughter to supper, you will find a plenty which to regale them in that cupboard. Now, good-bye, my brave boy. Tomorrow we must go to work again." Cecil seized his hand, which the printer offered, and exclaimed, "Oh, sir, sir!" This was all he could say, but his tears and the expression of his face were more eloquent than words. The gentleman withdrew, and Mary, who doubtless only waited for this movement to open the cupboard, now quickly turned the key in the lock, and the doors flew open and displayed a large pie, a roasted turkey, and two large loaves of bread. Cecil said to the masons, "Here is plenty for all. Come, sit down and eat with us."
"But there are only two chairs," said one of the masons.
"One for the blind man, and the other for Miss Mary," replied Cecil. "It is a fine evening," said Mary. "Let us sup in the open air. Carry the table outside, and we can place planks over the stones to make benches."
"Bravo, bravo," cried the masons, in executing Mary's orders. In a moment the table was set outside, the seats arranged, and the best one given to the blind man. All was gaiety and happiness, and never did any of the party enjoy a heartier or more jovial repast. Fox traveled all around the table, receiving food from the hand of everyone, and never did a dog so wag his tail as little Fox did during that merry meal. At 9 o'clock the party separated, and Cecil re-entered his little room alone. After having put everything in order, he threw himself on his knees before the bed and thanked God with great earnestness for all the blessings he had showered upon him for some days past. Then, for the first time since he had been in Paris, the poor child stretched his delicate limbs on a good bed.
"Oh, how delightful!" exclaimed he. "How delightful! If I had not been deprived of a bed so long as I have been, and had not been forced to sleep with only a bundle of straw for my pillow, I should never have known how great a luxury it is to sleep upon a mattress."
All at once he remembered his pigeons. He had quite forgotten them during the feast, and now wondered what had become of them. But the bed was too comfortable for him to long to indulge in vain regrets, and, tired from nature's sweet restorer, balmy sleep, soon banished his anxiety. The next morning, after Cecil had dressed himself and said his prayers, he went out in search of his pigeons. Great was his delight on finding a rude wooden cage hung on the wall just by his cottage. The pigeons were strutting up and down before the door. Beneath the cage was a grating, across which several planks were placed. Cecil looked in, fearfully at first, wondering what those brown-looking creatures, with long ears and bright eyes, could be. But suddenly he exclaimed,
"Oh, they are rabbits! Rabbits!"
He quickly divined to whom he was indebted for this new gift, and, after having fed his pigeons and his rabbits, he gathered a bundle of grass and, followed by Fox, set out on his way to the printing office, first intending to stop at the house of the gardener by whom Mary was employed to sell herbs, and leave the bundle of grass for the man's own rabbits. The gardener's wife had gone out, but Mary stood at the door. She perceived Cecil approaching with a bundle of grass, and cried out laughingly, "Oh, you have guessed Mother Grandjean's motive for making you a present of the pair of rabbits."
"No," replied Cecil, "but she has been so kind to give them to me, I thought I would return the kindness by bringing food for her rabbits. If she will permit me, Mary, I will bring her some grass every morning."
"Certainly she will be very glad to get it," replied Mary, taking the grass from Cecil.
"And how have you all been at home since yesterday evening?" asked Cecil.
"Better and happier than usual," replied Mary, "for my brother, ashamed of himself and much affected by the service you have rendered to our poor father, made us a great many promises to reform. It was a shame, he said, that a child 12 years of age should be wiser and better than he, who is 19, and he wept to think that he should be spending his money at a tavern, while that child was working to save our father from ruin. A good example should be followed, he said. Today he commences a new course of life, Cecil, and you have been the prompter of this happy change."
"Well, I don't know how that happens, Mary. The merit is not due to me. The good God directs everything, and to him we owe all we give the name of blessing to."
and his promptings have been well heeded by you. Oh, Cecil, my father said yesterday he had never before so much regretted the loss of his sight as when he remembered that he could not see you. Let us talk on some other subject, Mary. I have a favor to ask of you. As I told you yesterday, Mr. Germain allows me to take my meals at his house, but I have been used from childhood to change my linen very frequently, and I do not know how to get my clothes washed and mended. Do not give yourself any uneasiness about that, Cecil. Every week I will go to your house for your soiled or torn clothes, and my mother will put them in order. And I will pay her for it, said Cecil. Very well, very well. We will not dispute about that now. It is now time to go to work, said Cecil. Goodbye, Mary, until tomorrow. Goodbye, Cecil. And now, my little readers, it is useless to give a particular account of every day's doings. Cecil continued to work in the printing office, and, with the assistance of Mary's brother, cultivated his land, planted potatoes and salad, took good care of the fruit trees, repaired the wall, and made so many improvements that, at the expiration of 4 months, when Mr. Raymond returned from his travels, he did not recognize his own place. We will pass over the next 2 years, at the end of which time an unfortunate event occurred, which I will now relate. End of chapter 25. Chapter 26 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foix, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 26, in which something is told about Fox. One fine but very cold Sunday in the month of February, Cecil, followed by Fox, entered the church which he was accustomed regularly to attend. Could my little readers have seen Cecil, they would have scarcely recognized in the handsome and healthy-looking boy of 14 the pale and delicate child who, 2 years before, had been abandoned under the chestnut tree in the Tuileries. When the service was over, Cecil sat down on the church steps and amused himself by looking at the train of carriages with their liveried footmen as they drove up to the door, and by watching the richly dressed persons who stepped into them. Fox was not content with sitting still on the steps, but ran up to the carriages and jumped about the legs of the horses and footmen. After receiving several slight kicks, he would return quite crestfallen to his master. "That serves you right, Fox," cried out Cecil at every kick given to the dog. "You should not run away from me." But the dog took no heed either of his master's reproofs or of the ill-treatment of the footman, and again ran off to satisfy his curiosity. The people had nearly all left the church, and Cecil contemplated returning home to light his little fire and read a book which Mr. Germain had lent him, when he heard someone scream, "Fox! Fox!" Cecil started. The cry had proceeded from an old lady, seated in a carriage, the door of which was still open. As Cecil was looking around him, to divine what kind of dog it was that bore the same name as his own, he saw Fox, his Fox, make one bound and jump into the carriage where sat the lady. The door was closed in an instant, and the carriage drove off. When the first emotion of surprise was over, Cecil thought of following the carriage, but before he made up his mind what to do, the carriage was out of sight. Cecil was overwhelmed with grief. "I have lost my dog," exclaimed he, so bitterly that everybody turned around and looked at him. "I have lost my dog. Fox, Fox, come back! Where are you?" But he called in vain. Fox had perhaps disappeared forever. How should he ever find such a little dog in that great city? If he only looked particularly at that lady, or the carriage, or the horses, or the footmen, even, then he might have come and sat on the church steps every day, and if either the lady or her footman appeared, he could request them to return his dog. But now, what was he to do? The past seemed like a dream. The present was a sad reality, for he felt that he was alone. Sorrowfully, he returned home. Whenever he met a little black dog on his way, he involuntarily called out, "Fox!" And at every new disappointment, his grief was redoubled. Everything now looked gloomy in his pretty little cottage without Fox. Cecil neither noticed his pigeons nor his rabbits. All his thoughts were engrossed by Fox. He could not eat, nor sleep, nor take any pleasure without him. "Oh, he was more than a dog to me," exclaimed Cecil. "He was my companion, my brother, my friend." When he knelt down to pray that night, he could only utter one wish. "Oh, God, give me back my dog. Thou who hast always been good to me, give me back my friend, my companion." Sleep visited not poor Cecil's eyes that night, and when morning came, his grief seemed to be even greater than the preceding evening. Every moment he missed his dog more and more. Silently, he fed his rabbits and pigeons and set out for the printing office. In passing before the gardener's house, where Mary worked, instead of the gay and happy "Good morning," with which he generally accosted her, he held out his hand and could only say, "I have lost my dog, Mary." "What a misfortune," replied the girl, deeply sympathizing with his grief, without attempting to offer him any consolation. He arrived at the printing office, and to everybody addressed him. He replied only with the words which were uppermost in his heart and on his lips, "I have lost my dog."
"My wife will be inconsolable," said Mr. Germain, "but you must forget your grief for a time, my child. Work should be thought of before everything else."
Poor Cecil made errors all day, and never were his proof sheets so badly corrected.
"This child must have another dog," said Mr. Germain to the workman.
"No, no," replied Cecil, "not another. I only want the one I have lost. I could not love another dog as I have loved Fox."
End of chapter 26. Chapter 27 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 27. The Beggar on the Champs-Élysées. It was 7 o'clock in the evening. The moon shone brilliantly. The ground was covered with snow, and it was very cold when Cecil returned home. He passed by the coffee-house in which he had played on the violin for the old man. He was unfortunate then, but his dog was with him, and he was less sad than now. Standing near the coffee-house on the Champs-Élysées, he saw an individual who appeared familiar to him. It was a pale and thin young man, without a hat, shivering with the cold, wrapped in an old coat, which showed his form so plainly that one might well have imagined that beneath it he wore no other clothes. In this young man's feature, Cecil traced a resemblance to his cousin. But what an idea! The son of his uncle, the rich heir of Mr. Thomas, the owner of so many houses and vineyards in Bordeaux, here, in Paris, and in the most miserable and destitute state, shivering in the street. No, it was impossible. Notwithstanding the severe cold, Cecil stood still, with his eyes riveted upon the person who so strikingly resembled his cousin. At this moment,
A third person crossed the Champs-Élysées, and Cecil saw the wretched young man run towards the stranger and hold out his hand. "I have nothing for you," replied the person, thus applied to roughly.
"I shall die of hunger," said the young man,
who, no doubt, encouraged by the solitude which reigned all around, put his hand on the man's arm and held him fast, as it were, in perfect desperation. That voice! It was his cousin's voice. Cecil knew it too well to forget it, and, grasping the arm of the unhappy young man, exclaimed, "Augustus, what are you doing?"
"Augustus," repeated the person addressed, trembling with alarm, "who calls my name? Who knows me?"
And, in his surprise, unconscious of what he did, he loosened his hold of the strangers, who, glad to be released, hastened away.
"Augustus, what are you doing?"
again asked Cecil, but this time in sad and a reproachful tone, and fixing his eyes on his cousin with an expression of mingled astonishment and horror. The first feeling of alarm over, the man, in his turn, looked at Cecil, but not recognizing his voice, nor his healthy face and robust form, he said roughly,
"Who are you? And what do you want of me?"
"What? Do you not remember me, Augustus?"
"I never saw you before," said Augustus, making a movement to go away.
"I am Cecil." This name appeared to wound the young man to the soul.
"Cecil?" repeated he, with terror.
"Yes, the nephew of Mr. Thomas. Cecil, your cousin, whom you abandoned in the Tuileries. But what brings you to Paris, and what are you doing here?" added Cecil kindly.
As Augustus did not reply, feeling no doubt too much humble and confused, or not having an answer ready, Cecil continued,
"It is very cold here. Let us go to your house, or mine, that we may talk together. Will you?"
"To my house? I have no house," said Augustus, in a smothered voice. "Do you think, if I had a home, that I should be here, at this hour, prowling about the streets of Paris? Do you think, if I had eaten today, I would have begged?"
"Speak lower, Augustus," said Cecil. But he added, with kindness, "Well, come home with me, cousin."
Augustus followed, without making any remark, his head bent down, and his frame shivering with the cold. Cecil thought over this strange meeting with his cousin. Now a mendicant on the Champs-Élysées, until his little brain was perplexed. But he could not solve the mystery. As for Augustus, he was trying to invent some story which would satisfy his cousin's curiosity. They at length reached the little cottage, and when Cecil had lighted the candle, an exclamation of surprise burst from Augustus at the sight of the perfect neatness and order which reigned throughout the room.
"Where are we?" asked he.
"In my house, cousin," said Cecil, doing the honors with a hospitality worthy of his kind heart. "Wait, and I will light my fire, and that will warm you. You are hungry, are you not? Open the cupboard. What will you have? Here is bread, a pot of preserved grapes, and a little wine. But do you not stint yourself. Eat all. I am not hungry. I am too full of grief to think of eating," added he, drawing a deep sigh.
"Whose place is this?"
asked Augustus, eating with great anxiety.
"It is mine, or pretty much the same as mine," answered Cecil.
"What?" said Augustus, in astonishment. "This land belongs to you? This house and furniture are yours?"
"No, this land is not mine," replied Cecil. "I am only kept here to guard it. The house, some of my friends built it for me. Still, it can hardly be called mine either, but the furniture and everything in this room belong to me. But, cousin, tell me something about yourself. How happens it that you, who were so rich, are in this forlorn condition?"
"Oh, it is a very sad history," replied Augustus.
"It is not late," said Cecil. "Pray, relate it to me."
Augustus, having finished his supper, took the most comfortable seat in front of the fire, and commenced his story. End of chapter 27. Chapter 28 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foa, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 28. What Brings Prosperity and What Misfortune?
I have had misfortunes. This is all my history, said Augustus, affecting an indifferent air.
And I have had prosperity, replied Cecil. But as my good fortune has all one cause, your misfortunes have probably one also. Is it not so?
That is to say, you have told everybody that you had been abandoned, without omitting to mention, I will wager, by whom, giving my name, the particulars of my birth, my place of residence, and even the street in which I lived, and the number of my house.
How little you know of me, Augustus, replied Cecil calmly. Have I not always been taught that to publish the wickedness of one's relations was to dishonor oneself? I have told those who asked my history that I was abandoned, but I never told by whom.
What, Cecil? Never mentioned my name?
Never, Augustus.
And what has been the cause of all your good fortune?
Cecil related to his cousin, in the most simple and natural manner, and without the least embellishment, all that had occurred to him from the time Augustus had forsaken him in the garden of the Tuileries.
And now, added he, in conclusion, tell me about your misfortunes.
Alas, Cecil, after leaving you asleep in the Tuileries, I started the same day on my return to Bordeaux. On my arrival there, I began by clearing out the house.
What? Augustus, you turned away Jean and his family, Jeannette, old Bonice, and little Lignac, all the family servants, born and bred in the house? Interrupted Cecil.
They did nothing but talk of you, replied Augustus sulkily.
Oh, I understand, said Cecil, and it was a reproach to yourself.
Was I not the master of my own house, and could I not do what I chose? Demanded Augustus.
Ay, Augustus, and so was I master this evening, and need not have asked you to come home with me, replied Cecil. But I would not have asked it thus, Augustus.
Augustus, without paying any attention to this remark, continued.
Never ask a man, Cecil, how he has managed to spend the whole of his fortune in 6 months. It was very easy, I can assure you. Listen, and I will tell you. I had new servants who stole from me, and friends who borrowed my money. I gave parties. I kept carriages and horses. Then I got in debt by bad speculations, and one morning I found myself dispossessed of all my houses and my vineyards, with only 10,000 francs in my purse.
I should like very well to have 10,000 francs.
I should think myself rich, replied Cecil.
You have then 10,000 francs, Augustus?
Hear me to the end. I knew that gaming houses were abolished in Paris, but I had heard my father speak of speculation in stocks, by which enormous sums were made. I came to Paris, risked my 10,000 francs, and lost them. Since then, I have had to sell my clothes one by one to pay my board and get food, until yesterday, not being able to pay for a small room I occupied in the Faubourg Saint-Thomas street, they turned me out of the house and retained the rest of my linen. When you met me, I had not eaten anything for 14 hours.
How fortunate that I met you, said Cecil.
You do not, then, bear malice against me? Asked Augustus in surprise.
Why, said Cecil, I felt angry with you as long as I thought you were rich. Now that you are unfortunate, I pity you, but bear you no malice. If you will recall the words of your poor father, Augustus,
that he who does evil receives evil in return, and he that does good find good in return. You will see how you have deserved your misfortunes, and I my prosperity."
"How stupid you are!" exclaimed Augustus, shrugging his shoulders. "If you had not met that good man, Mr. Amon, who made you guardian over his land, and those kind masons who built your house, tell me, if you can, where you could have lived until now," Cecil replied quickly.
"If I had not assisted the old blind man, I should not have met Mr. Raymond, and the comrades of the blind man's son would not have built me this room."
"Say rather," replied Augustus, "that without your dog all this good fortune would not have befallen you."
"But it was from compassion that I took the dog, and God had pity on me because I had pity on the dog."
"Oh, you make it all out to suit yourself," said Augustus, who, in the spirit of all envious persons, would not acknowledge to himself the cause of his misery and of his cousin's happiness. "After all," added he, "you are not so well off as to justify your talking so proudly."
"And what more could I want?" exclaimed Cecil with animation. "I have a house, quite large enough for my use. I have friends. Yes, Augustus, the old blind man's family are excellent friends to me. The old man gives me good advice. His wife washes and mends my clothes. His daughter, a kind and grateful girl, has given me a pair of pigeons and a pair of rabbits, of which I am very fond, and his son, a rather unsteady young man at first, but now quite changed, often comes, after he has got through his work, to help me plough and sow my ground. I have a situation by which I make 60 francs a month, and in the name of goodness, what more do I want? Ah, except my dog, to be sure," he added with a sigh. "But, this misfortune apart, I should be very ungrateful to complain of my destiny, comparing my situation now with what it was 2 years ago, when I was a poor, deserted child, wandering about the streets of Paris, with only 1 cent in my pocket."
"Is there no possibility of sleeping here?" asked Augustus, concealing by a yawn the displeasure he felt at Cecil's last remark.
"Oh, yes," replied Cecil, "but I can only offer you half a bed, as I have only one."
"I will try and content myself with that," said Augustus, undressing himself and jumping into bed.
"Do you not say your prayers?" asked Cecil, kneeling down.
"What's the use?" said Augustus, turning over and composing himself to sleep.
"Oh, cousin," said Cecil sadly, "how do you ever expect to be happy?"
And finding that his cousin did not reply, he added,
"I am going to pray for you, as you grieve me very much."
"You will do well," replied Augustus roughly. But just as Cecil was commencing to pray, he thought he heard in the stillness of the night the barking of a dog which he knew well.
"Augustus! Augustus!" cried he, his voice much changed by emotion, and running to open the door. "Can you now deny the justice and goodness of God? Let me convince you. See, see, he has given me back my dog, my own, my Fox!"
A moment afterwards Cecil clasped Fox to his heart, and then, weeping for joy, he fell on his knees to thank the giver of all good. End of chapter 28. Chapter 29 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugénie Foix, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 29. The Placard.
"It is strange, cousin, that Fox don't like you," said Cecil the next morning, perceiving that the dog continually whined and looked suspiciously at Augustus.
"Do you mean to say that dogs love and hate?" asked Augustus.
"Is it not proof sufficient that this poor dog, who was carried away from me
and whom I thought lost, has come back to me of his own accord? Have you not been witness of his joy at seeing me? But let us think of your affairs now, Augustus."
"I thank you for your hospitality," said Augustus, while dressing himself and brushing his old coat to make it look less soiled and dusty. "I am going to see some friends. Have you a cravat and shirt to lend me?"
"Yes," replied Cecil, selecting his handsomest cravat and best shirt and presenting them to him.
"And some money with which I may buy my breakfast?" asked Augustus. Cecil took a little leather purse out of his mattress and, opening it, said,
"I have 30 francs. I will share them with you, Augustus. Here are 15. I am very sorry not to be able to offer you more."
Augustus, who did not anticipate his cousin's generosity, was much surprised, and thanked him quite warmly, saying,
"You are a very good friend, Cecil, but I will return this money soon, very soon," added he, taking the money, as though it were a loan, by way of easing his pride. For those who are incapable of doing a generous act themselves are always unwilling to show a proper degree of gratitude for a favor received. After Cecil has given his pigeons and rabbits their breakfast, he invited his cousin to accompany him, and they went out together. In approaching the Place de la Concorde, the two cousins saw a placard posted on a tree in the Champs-Élysées, before which several people stopped a moment, then walked on.
"What is lost?" asked the cousins, following the examples of others and stopping to read. But instead of passing on, as if by one impulse, they stood transfixed to the spot.
My little readers will quickly see the cause of Cecil's agitation when they read the placard, but they will not be able to guess in what manner it interested Augustus. Augustus read the notice aloud.
50 francs reward for the recovery of a little English spaniel. The dog is black, with a white spot on his breast and on each foot. His ears are very long, almost sweeping the ground, and his name is Fox. This dog has been lost for 2 years, but was found on last Sunday, before the church of Saint Roch, and made his escape last evening. If anybody who sees the above-mentioned dog will please bring him to No. 37 Lafitte Street, to Madame Marbouffe, he will receive the promised reward, and even more if required.
Madame Marbouffe, said Augustus, thoughtfully, it is singular.
My poor dog, said Cecil, taking Fox tenderly in his arms.
The cousins walked away from the placard, and separated from each other, both of them absorbed in thought. Cecil went to the printing office, and immediately related all that occurred to Mr. Germain, and asked his advice.
"My advice is this, poor child," replied Mr. Germain, "that since you cannot keep that dog, seeing that it does not belong to you, my advice is that you immediately return it to its owner."
"Never, never, of my own accord," said Cecil, "could I part with Fox."
"Reflect, my child," said Mr. Germain, "that apart from receiving the reward, which it would be very nice for you to have, and which you could double if you choose, you will be accused of stealing the dog."
"Stealing!" exclaimed Cecil.
"But, my child," said Mr. Germain, "there is not much difference between stealing and keeping what belongs to another."
"Then I will no longer hesitate," said Cecil, taking Fox in his arms and weeping over him. Then stopping at the door of the printing office, and turning to his comrades, who looked sorrowfully after him, he said, "Do you think that I might ask the lady to let me buy her dog?"
"You have a perfect right to ask," replied one of the compositors. "And she has a perfect right to refuse you," said Mr. Germain.
With a sad heart, Cecil went on his way, carrying the poor animal, who looked up to his master, as if he anticipated his fate.
and supplicated him not to part with him. End of chapter 29. Chapter 30 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 30. A Disappointment. "Give me courage," prayed poor Cecil, looking at the dog, who seemed dearer to him than ever before. He arrived at the house designated in the placard. As he ascended the steps, he met his cousin, who hastened to join him. "What do you come here for?" asked Cecil.
"And for what do you come?" returned Augustus.
"I," said Cecil, and he looked sorrowfully at the little dog in his arms.
"Ah, you have come for the promised reward," said Augustus.
It would be difficult to express Cecil's indignation at this remark without saying a word, for he felt if his cousin could thus judge him, he was not capable of either conceiving or appreciating his conduct. He knocked at the door.
"Cecil," cried Augustus, "do not speak of me to that lady. Do you understand?"
"What an idea!" exclaimed Cecil. And he asked the doorkeeper for Mrs. Marbouf.
"Go to the first door on the left," said the doorkeeper. "Oh, you bring back her dog. Are you not glad to have found it? You will get the reward. I never met with such good luck."
Cecil bowed to all the woman's remarks without replying. He went to the next door as she directed and rang. A liveried footman opened the door, and, on seeing the dog, exclaimed, like the doorkeeper,
"Oh, you have brought Mrs. Marbouf's dog. She will be delighted."
And, leading Cecil through a suite of rooms, the magnificence of which quite escaped his attention, the servant ushered him to a little boudoir, where an old lady was seated in a large armchair before a cheerful fire, embroidering with worsteds. The footman said, as he opened the door, "Madame, here is Fox."
"Fox! Fox!"
exclaimed the lady, throwing down her work and extending her arms to the dog.
"Fox, do you not remember your mistress? You ungrateful little wretch!"
But Fox and his master both remained standing in the door.
"Fox," said Mrs. Marbouf tenderly, "what is the matter with you, that you do not know me? Here is one of the little cakes that you used to like so much."
Fox wagged his tail in token of his thanks, but did not advance a step towards his old mistress. During the few minutes that Madame Marbouf coaxed Fox, Cecil surveyed the lady. She was about 60 years of age. Her countenance was full, unfurrowed by disease or care, and bore traces of great beauty. Its expression was neither stern nor mild, but it was cold. Cecil ventured to say,
"You see, madame, the dog grieves at our separation as much as I do."
For the first time, Madame Marbouf looked towards the child, who came to restore her dog.
"I thank you," said she. "Leave the dog."
Then, turning to the servant, she added,
"Peter, give 50 francs to this child. Go with him, my little friend."
Seeing that Cecil did not appear inclined to obey, she added, in the same calm tone,
"Is the reward not sufficient, and do you wish it increased?"
"I wish to speak to you, madame," said Cecil, endeavouring to repress his tears.
"What hinders you? Speak on," said the lady.
"Madame," said Cecil timidly, "let me keep Fox. Fox is my friend, my brother. Fox is everything to me, madame. I am a poor, forsaken child. I have no family. If you knew, madame, oh, I entreat you to let me keep Fox."
"Well, this is a strange child,"
said Madame Marbouf, perfectly unmoved.
Then she added, smiling kindly, "I am sorry for you, child, but the dog is mine, and I choose to keep him. Go with Peter. Ask as much as you choose, and he will pay you anything in reason."
"But I only want Fox, madame. I do not care for anything but Fox," said Cecil, no longer able to restrain his grief. "Oh, do not refuse him to me. You are rich. You have a house, servants, and children, perhaps. You have everything you want. I have only Fox. See, madame, how the poor animal looks at me. If he could speak, I am sure he would beg you not to separate us. Oh, madame, have pity on us both."
Without appearing in the least affected by this touching appeal, Madame Marbouf coldly turned to her servant and said, "Peter, take this child away and give him 100 francs. Go, my friend, 100 francs will be of much more use to you than a dog."
"You, madame, perhaps might think so," said Cecil, who had become bold through vexation. "But I might not agree with you. Since you think that money can replace a friend, sell me your dog. Sell him to me. How much do you wish for him? If I have not the sum required, I can work, madame. I will earn it and bring it to you. For how much will you sell him, madame?"
"Was there ever such a queer child?" exclaimed the lady. "Peter, take this boy away, and give him 100 francs, as I told you." Cecil attempted to reply, but Madame Marbouf prevented him. "Silence! Not a word more! You have said enough," said she, so positively that he did not venture to open his lips, but followed Peter, without even looking back at the poor dog, which his mistress held on her lap, and who whined piteously when the door closed on his young benefactor. Cecil was disconsolately leaving the house without asking for the reward. The servant called out to him,
"Well, are you going without the 100 francs? Wait till I count them out to you." "Thank you. I do not wish them," said Cecil, weeping. "Your mistress is a bad woman, and I do not wish to receive anything from her."
"My mistress is not bad," replied Peter.
"She is good, then, I suppose," returned Cecil.
"She is not exactly good, either," said the servant.
"And what, then, is she?" asked Cecil.
"Why, she is fortunate, my little friend. She has never suffered, never had any sorrows, and she cannot understand how others can be unhappy. She is a woman who, when she sees others suffer, does not suppose they are feigning, but she does not soothe them through a natural impulse. Thus it is not sufficient for a poor person to tell her he is hungry. She would only reply that she was very sorry. But if he should ask her to give him something to eat, she would comply with his request. For the same reason a person must not tell her he is cold, he must ask her to give him something to clothe himself with. So you see, my little friend, she cannot be called bad."
"Neither can she be called good," replied Cecil, leaving the house.
"Here is your money," the servant called out after him.
"I have not earned it, or I have not well earned it," replied Cecil, looking back. "For before evening your mistress's dog will return to my house."
Saying these words, he bowed politely to the servant and walked on. He did not return to the printing office, but, after walking a block, seated himself on a step and began to whistle.
"Are you not going to the printing office today?" asked Augustus,
whom Cecil had not observed in turning down the street.
"No, I intend passing the day here," replied Cecil.
"The fool," muttered Augustus between his teeth, hastily walking away. Cecil was too much absorbed in his own thoughts to notice his words, and sat still, whistling. End of chapter 30.
Chapter 31 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry Triumph, by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 31. The Printers and the 100 Francs. Fox, who had escaped from his former mistress out of love for his young master, when he heard Cecil whistle, surmounted every obstacle to obey the summons. Cecil had calculated upon this, and he was more pleased than surprised when, after half an hour, Fox, overjoyed and out of breath, leaped upon him. Cecil returned to the printing office, and when the old proofreader beheld him enter, accompanied by his dog, he shook his head and said severely, "Then you had not sufficient resolution to give back the dog?" "That was not right, young man. You have not behaved well." Cecil, to exculpate himself, simply related what had taken place within the last hour. Instantly, all the printers, compositors, and men employed in the office gathered round him.
"I would have kept the dog," said one.
"I would have taken the 100 francs," said another.
"I would have spoken my mind to the old lady," said a third.
"Ah," replied Cecil, "it is not such an easy matter to talk to an old lady who looks very proud and speaks in a peremptory tone that seems to forbid an answer. For my part, I could not keep from crying, and entreated her to permit me to retain the dog."
"That was well done. And what did she say?"
"She offered me more money, and seemed to think that that should compensate me for the loss of my dog, my dear Fox, my best friend."
"And why had you not the wit to offer her the 100 francs if she would only let you keep the dog?" asked the proofreader.
"That is exactly what I did, and she laughed in my face."
"That was because she supposed you had not 100 francs to give," said a compositor named Andrew. "Now, if you had only showed them to her—"
"I could not show her what is not mine to show," answered Cecil. "But I told her that I would earn them, and that I would pay her whatever sum she would choose to ask."
"That would not do. That would never do," exclaimed several of the printers at once. "A person can resist a promise, but if he only sees the money glittering before him, the temptation is too great."
"But I have not 100 francs. I have only 15, replied Cecil despondently.
"And would you willingly give the money for the sake of recovering your dog?" questioned Gaspard.
"That I would. I will give 15 francs that I shall receive next week, and the week after, and the week after that, and after that, until the 100 is made up. Oh, that I would right gladly to feel that Fox was mine."
"Very well, I will arrange everything for you," said Gaspard, jumping upon Mr. Germain's tall stool that he might command the attention of the workmen, and then addressing them thus, "Comrades, our friend here, and he is our friend, our true friend, is threatened with what to him would be a misfortune, the loss of his dog, the greatest treasure he has in the world, the chief source of his happiness. Comrades, 100 francs would save him from this misfortune. Can not we among us make up that sum and present it to him? We are most of us indebted to him for some kindness, which we may now return. For my part, I cannot bear to lose the little dog. I have become accustomed to him, and his tricks amuse me. Gentlemen, I will set you the example." With these last words, Gaspard placed his hat on the ground and threw into it a piece of money.
"I will follow your lead," said Mr. Germain, dropping a 5-franc piece into the hat, "for I cannot do without Fox, nor can my wife either."
"Nor I," said the printers, one after another, fumbling in their pockets and dropping a coin into Gaspard's hat.
"Oh, my poor Fox!
how much everybody loves you," said Cecil, in a voice tremulous with emotion. "How good you are, my friends! How shall I ever thank you?"
"And are you not better than any of us, although you are so much younger?" asked one of the printers. "Did you not give me 30 sous one day, when I wanted to pay for my new coat and fell short of money?"
"And when I was sick last month," said another, "did you not bring me some sugar and wine and several other things which I could not procure for myself because I had spent every cent of my wages?
And did you not come and read from Robinson Crusoe every evening to amuse my children?" said a third. "And are you not always doing something to assist us?"
Cecil was too much overcome by the kindness of his friends to answer. Gaspard counted the money, and, finding that it amounted to exactly 100 francs, he wrapped it in a piece of paper, and, taking down his coat, asked Cecil Madame Marbouf's address, and saying that he intended making the proposition to the lady himself, quitted the office. End of Chapter 31. Chapter 32 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 32. A New Project. During Gaspard's absence, everybody in the printing office seemed unusually silent. Even Fox ceased to play, and Cecil, though he tried to attend to his ordinary duties, looked abstracted, and his eyes glanced over the pages without his comprehending a line. In about an hour, Gaspard re-entered the office. He flung his hat upon the table, silently pulled off his coat, and hung it up, and, placing the money on the counter, threw himself into a chair, in evident ill humor. Everybody was anxious to interrogate him, and yet they all remained silent. The intelligence of his ill success had been communicated without words.
"Her heart is made of stone!" suddenly exclaimed Gaspard. "Cecil was right. She laughed in my face."
"I am quite as much obliged to you," said Cecil, pressing Gaspard's hand, "as if you had succeeded in your errand. But I have a new idea, and you must tell me what you think of it."
"I suppose we are not to have any work today," said the principal proofreader, interrupting Cecil.
"Do not say that," answered Gaspard. "In 1/4 of an hour we will all be at our post again. Come, Cecil, what is your new project?"
"It is this," replied Cecil. "It appears that Madame Marbouf thinks more of dogs than of human beings, for our tears could not move her as much as the caresses of her dog. Suppose we let Fox plead for himself."
"I can see only one objection to that," said Gaspard. "It is that Fox has never yet learned to speak."
"But Fox might send her a letter, that is—"
Gaspard interrupted Cecil with, "Ah, Fox is a scholar, then, one of the learned quadrupeds. He understands penmanship." Cecil could not help smiling at this observation, but replied without being at all discouraged.
"All great personages have secretaries, you know, and Fox is a great personage, since we have had so much trouble about him. Why can I not be his secretary?"
"And I will be his letter-bearer," said Adrienne. "That would never do," observed Mr. Germain. "The lady would order one of her domestics to follow you, and the abode of Fox would instantly be discovered. We will send the letter through the post-office."
"Right, right," cried all the printers.
Fox was not even consulted. Cecil placed himself at a desk, and after writing several commencements of his letter and tearing them up, he completed the following epistle.
"My dear and honored mistress, 2 years ago I was lost in the Tuileries. I was driven about from corner to corner, and at the last a sentinel pierced me several times with his bayonet. I was severely hurt, and should have died of my wounds, or of hunger, for everybody refused to protect me, until a child, a young boy, who, like myself, was friendless and forsaken, and, like me, almost dying of hunger, took pity on me. He washed my wounds at the fountain in the Tuileries, and tore his only handkerchief in two to bind them up. He had only one cent in the world, with which he bought some bread. A kind girl gave him a slice, which cost 2 cents, and he divided it up with me. You see, madame, these are things which cannot be forgotten. I am only a dog, but I have a heart, and I have not forgotten them. Since the time I have just spoken of, this child and I have always remained together. He would have refused any employment which forced him to part with me. I would not have sought shelter in a house where my benefactor was not welcome. You, madame, I shall always see with pleasure. If you would permit it, I would come and visit you sometime, on Sundays, for instance. But do not hope that I will ever forsake my master. I assure you, I will never willingly do so. You have the right to take me by force, but I do not think that you can make me remain. Were you to tie me, I would break my chain. Were you to shut me up, I should jump out the window, or whine so dolefully that you could not bear to hear me. And if I could not escape, I should pine away with grief, and finally die. You would then have gained nothing yourself, and you would have deprived an unhappy child of his best and dearest friend and companion. You will say that I am an ungrateful little brute, but I do not think I am so. Do I owe you more than I owe Cecil? You are rich, and you bought me, perhaps, at a very extravagant price. Cecil did not buy me, but he saved my life. My master begs that I will offer you the 100 francs at which you valued me, and I promise you, on the word of a spaniel, to pay you my respects every Sunday after church, and to make myself as agreeable and as interesting as possible. I hope, madame, that you will honor me with an answer addressed to Fox the Spaniel, Paris. Accept my assurances of profound respect and sincere attachment. As I am not very skillful in signing my name, you will find my mark at the bottom of this sheet. Cecil called Fox, and, lightly rubbing one of his front paws in the printing ink, laid the paw upon the part of the letter to which the name of the writer should have been affixed. Fox remained perfectly quiet, and, when Cecil removed his paw, it left a perfect impression of its size and form. Cecil then read the letter to the printers, and it met with their hearty approval. The letter was then folded, sealed, and addressed, and Adrienne carried it to the post office. End of chapter 32. Chapter 33 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugénie Foix, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 33. The Post Office. One morning, the head clerk of the post office, who was sorting the letters, stopped at one, the address of which he read several times. First he read it without spectacles, then with his spectacles, then he removed his spectacles from his eyes, rubbed the glasses, put them on again, and once more read the address of the letter. "To Fox the Spaniel, Paris," said he aloud. "What can that mean? A letter to a dog?
I have been clerk of this post office 30 years, and I never heard of such a thing."
At that moment, a scratching upon the door made him turn his head. He opened the door, and a little black dog, with a folded piece of paper in his mouth, sprang into the room. The clerk took the paper, and, opening it, found that it contained 3 cents. On examining the paper more particularly, he found these words traced upon it: "If there is a letter at the post office addressed to Fox the Spaniel, the clerk will have the goodness to take this money for the postage and give the letter to the bearer." The man rubbed his eyes, as though he thought he was dreaming, and glanced from the paper to the letter, and then at the dog, who stood as though he was waiting for an answer. And he held the letter towards him. Fox seized the letter and made his escape. A moment afterwards, a footman in green livery entered the office and said, "You have received a letter addressed to Fox the Spaniel. Has anybody called for it?"
"Yes, this very minute. The person to whom it was addressed has just carried it away with him. You must have met him on the steps."
"Was it a little boy?" asked the servant.
"Not at all. It was the spaniel himself, a little black dog. I dare say he is not yet out of sight."
The servant opened the door and saw at some distance a little boy, who held an open letter in his hand, while a small black dog was gambolling beside him. Before the servant could follow them, they had turned the corner and were out of sight. End of chapter 33. Chapter 34 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Fauat, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 34. The Answer to Fox's Letter. The letter, which Cecil held in his hand, ran as follows:
"My dear Fox, I have neither the time nor the talent which your secretary possesses. Therefore, I cannot write what I wish to say to you. Have the goodness to come and see me as soon as you receive this letter. Your former mistress, Antoinette Marbeuf."
Cecil read the letter to his friends at the printing office, and then consulted with them concerning the course which he should pursue.
"I should go," said one. "I should not go," cried another. "Nor I," said a third.
"I do not agree with you," said Cecil. "This lady has a right to the dog. I think I ought to hear what she should say. I will go and ask Mr. Germain to permit me to leave the office for an hour."
Cecil approached Mr. Germain and made his request.
"It seems to me, Master Cecil," replied the proof-reader angrily, "that nothing in this office is thought of but Fox. Fox has set everybody crazy. Nobody attends to his work today, and the cause is that you are all thinking of Fox. I want you to read these proofs. And you tell me you must go and see the former mistress of Fox."
"I will not be absent long, Mr. Germain," said Cecil, half timidly and half coaxingly.
The old proof-reader looked at him, and could not help smiling.
"Then be off with you," said he. "You cajoling little rogue, there is no use ever saying no to you."
Cecil ran off, almost without thanking Mr. Germain. Fox, as usual, accompanied him. He was soon in Lafitte Street, in front of Madame Morbeuf's house. He was going to ring when he observed that the door was open. He paused a moment without entering, and heard voices apparently engaged in angry discussion.
"I tell you, leave my house and never enter it again," said one voice, which Cecil recognized as that of Madame Marbeuf. "But if I find him,
"'And I bring him to you,' said the other voice, which Cecil thought sounded like that of his cousin. "'I will receive him,' replied Madame Marbeuf. "'But as for you, I never wish to see you again. Leave me, sir!'
"'But, Madame, think!' pleaded Augustus in a supplicating tone.
Madame Marbeuf interrupted him.
"'Leave me, sir! I have nothing further to say to you.'
At that moment Cecil heard steps rapidly approaching, and before he could retire his cousin stood before him. Augustus stopped when he saw Cecil, and demanded in a low and trembling voice,
"'What do you want here?'
"'I want to see Madame Marbeuf,' replied Cecil calmly. Augustus convulsingly caught hold of Cecil's arm, and, forcibly drawing him away, said,
"'Come with me, come with me. She is a good-for-nothing woman, a monster!'
In his agitation he knocked against a tall, fat gentleman who was ascending the steps. Cecil looked up and exclaimed,
"'Ah, Mr. Raymond, kind Mr. Raymond, is it you?'
"'What?' "'Cecil, my little Robinson Crusoe, is it you? Whom have you with you?'
"'My cousin,' replied Cecil.
"'And what are you doing here?' asked Mr. Raymond, addressing Augustus. "'Let us go! Let us go!' said Augustus, leading Cecil away without replying to Mr. Raymond.
Augustus appeared pale, ill, and agitated, and Cecil, who attributed his cousin's haste to indisposition, had not the heart to oppose his wishes. End of chapter 34. Chapter 35 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugénie Foix, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 35. The Summons. When Cecil entered the printing office again with his dog, the printers all asked him the news, and the child related all that had passed, and what he had heard while standing at the door of Madame Marbeuf's house.
"'You have a cousin, then, Cecil? You said you had no family,' said Mr. Germain.
"'I only found him yesterday evening,' replied Cecil, "'but I did not speak to you of him, because I do not like to talk of my cousin.'
"'He is not amiable, then, my little fellow.
"'You know, Mr. Germain, a tree bears both good and bad fruits.' "'But I have not said anything to make you suppose that my cousin bears any bad fruit.'
Mr. Germain smiled.
"'No, nor any good either, have you. Come, let us have no mystery. I thought that your cousin was rich, and that he did not notice you because you were poor.'
"'My cousin is poorer than I am,' replied Cecil.
"'I would like to know,' said one of the printers, "'Why, Madame Marbeuf is a monster!' "'Gentlemen, we have had enough of Madame Marbeuf. Let us now go to work,' said Mr. Germain, striking his fist authoritatively on the table. "'Cecil, I have some errands for you. Take these proof sheets to the different persons whose names you will find on this list. By the by, Cecil, we will not have any dinner cooked at our house today, as my wife and I are going to dine with her mother. You can dine where you choose. Do you understand?
I will dine at home, then, replied Cecil, and I shall not return to the printing office again today, as my cousin has put my room in such disorder that I should be glad to have a little time to arrange it before night.
Look here, Cecil, said one of the printers, handing him some proof sheets. "'I am very curious to see your little house, of which I have heard our master speak so often. Shall I bring my dinner there?'
"'It would give me much pleasure if you did,' replied Cecil.
"'Well, we two shall dine together.'
"'Oh, I did not say only we two. You're not afraid of seeing anybody else, are you?' replied Cecil.
"'Who will be there? Do you expect company?'
"'A very select circle,' answered Cecil.
"I must arrange my toilette, then," said the printer, surveying himself head to foot. "Will there be any ladies?"
"Yes," said Cecil, "Lady Pigeons and Lady Rabbits. Goodbye. Remember, it is on the Champs-Élysées, near the Garden of Beaujon, on Mr. Raymond's tract of land. Everybody knows where it is. Come, Fox."
Cecil had hardly left the office when a footman in green and gold livery entered. "Sir," said he, addressing one of the printers, "does not a boy named Cecil work here? A little boy who has a black spaniel called—"
"Fox," interrupted the printer, "they have both gone home."
"I come with a message from Madame Marbeuf," said the footman.
"And what does Madame Marbeuf wish?" asked Mr. Germain, advancing towards the footman. "If you can leave a message, we will deliver it to Cecil."
"She wishes him to come immediately to her house," replied the footman.
"He has gone out now and will not return today," said Mr. Germain. "But tomorrow we will tell him."
"Madame wished to see him today, but if that cannot be, tomorrow will answer," replied the footman, bowing and retiring. End of chapter 35.
Chapter 36 of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foy, translated by Lucy Landon. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 36, The Conclusion. By the time that Cecil had finished his errands, it was already dusk. He hastily returned home and met the printer whom he had invited to dinner, standing at a short distance from his cottage.
"Is that your house?" asked the man.
"Yes," replied Cecil, who, to his great astonishment, perceived that his door was half open.
"Well, take care, Cecil," said the printer in an altered voice. "It is full of people."
Cecil looked at Fox, who, after having made several joyous bounds at his master, ran into the house.
"Look there," said Cecil. "My dog answers you that friends only are there. Mr. Raymond is the only person besides myself who has a key, and, as I did not open the door, he must have done so. Let us enter."
As Cecil walked boldly into the cottage, the printer followed mistrustfully. Cecil could hardly believe his senses when he recognized Madame Marbeuf, seated on one of his two chairs, and Mr. Raymond on the other. The blind man, his son, and Mary stood near. And beside them was the old invalid caressing Fox and calling him Austerlitz. Some distance behind this group, concealing himself as though in shame, stood Augustus, looking pale and haggard. Madame Marbeuf appeared much moved, and Mr. Raymond was uneasily beating his cane on the ground. The blind man's head was bent forward, as though he was attentively listening to every sound, that he might divine what was going on around him. Mary and Paul were weeping, but their tears were of joy rather than grief. Madame Marbeuf was the first to speak.
"Come here, my child," said she, extending her hand to Cecil, "and tell me why, notwithstanding my note, you did not come to my house this morning."
Before Cecil had time to reply, Augustus stepped forward with a sad but resolute air, and said in a voice full of emotion,
"It was my fault, madame. I am very culpable. Ah, Cecil, you were right in saying that our good and evil acts brought the one reward and the other punishment. Your history and mine prove that this is true. My first bad action was the burning of my father's will, which ensured you a comfortable income for life. By this means I deprived myself of the power to save my father's fortune, the details of which were only given in his will. You know with what unnatural cruelty I took you to Paris, and there forsook you, without even giving you a cent. Since that time, Cecil, your image has haunted me in my sleep. Often I awoke, pale and frightened, and thought I heard your voice, which sometimes plaintively begged me for food, and sometimes, threateningly, called me the murderer, an assassin. Ah, oh, those nights! Just God, what nights! I often lay without daring to close my eyes for fear of seeing your image, which appalled me. Here Augustus paused for a moment, overcome by his feelings. Soon he continued. On returning to Bordeaux, I learned that my father's only remaining sister, of whom he never spoke in our presence because he had, many years ago, quarrelled with her husband, had arrived in the city. This sister had heard of her brother's dangerous illness and wished to see him again before he died. She was a widow and rich. These two circumstances were sufficient to make me call upon her. Her first inquiry was after her nephew Cecil. She said that as you were without fortune, it was her intention to make you her heir. She asked to see you. I concealed my wickedness, and told her that your education had been so much neglected that I had taken you to Paris and placed you at college. My aunt praised me for this judicious action, and requested me to give her the address of the college. I gave her the first name that came into my head. She returned to Paris, and as you may suppose, Cecil, I soon received a letter from her. She told me I had deceived her, and insisted upon knowing where you were. Not being able to reply, I did not answer her letter. As I told you, I was robbed, duped, and deceived. I lost the fortune I was unworthy of possessing, and came to Paris, where I completed my ruin. He then addressed Madame Marbeuf. One evening, when I was almost dying with hunger, I stopped a man on the Champs-Élysées and asked for bread, as a robber would demand money. But I was unarmed. I did not mean to harm him. Though I am guilty of much wickedness, madame, my punishment would be too severe if you believed me capable of wishing to take the life of one of my fellow-creatures. Alas, I was a beggar. But I was only begging. When the voice of a child struck on my ear, the hand of a child was placed on my arm. It was the same voice that I heard every night in my dreams. I turned and beheld the same face that had appeared at the foot of my bed every night. "Who calls me?" demanded I, trembling so violently that the man I had arrested made his escape. "It is I, Cecil," replied my cousin, for it was really he, but not as in my dreams portrayed him, pale and famished. He looked healthy and robust, and almost happy. It was with difficulty I recognized him. Cecil succored me, who had turned him out of my father's house. He received me in his room, me, who had stolen the only legacy left him by my father. He shared with me the money he had earned by the sweat of his brow, with me, who had so cruelly abandoned him when he needed my protection. He came to me kind and forgiving, and, without one reproach, without one taunting observation, said, "Enter, eat, and sleep." Do you think, madame, that I was softened by this noble and generous conduct? No. The demon envy had taken possession of me. I was envious that Cecil was better off than I, that he was living comfortably while I was dying with hunger. I envied his gaiety, which sprang from a clear conscience, his prosperity, which came through his own goodness. And in the morning I awoke in his bed, in spite of his kindness, with anger in my heart. Oh, Cecil, do not turn from me in horror, for that anger has been succeeded by repentance the most sincere, by remorse the most poignant. We rose, we dressed ourselves, we went out. The placard about Fox first attracted our attention. Cecil read it with pain, and I with joy. I set out for your house, madame, but I stopped on the way to take breakfast, and when I arrived I found Cecil, with his dog, entering your door. I awaited with great inquiet the result of the interview, which might disclose all my wickedness. I did not wish Cecil to have any idea of the tie between us three. For Madame Marbeuf is our aunt, Cecil, the sister of my father and of your mother.
Yes, Cecil, said Madame Marbeuf, I am your aunt, and in future my house and my fortune are yours. Come and embrace me, my dear child.
Cecil, astonished, looked first at his aunt, who held out her arms to him, then at Mr. Raymond, who made a sign for him to go and embrace Madame Marbeuf, then at the weeping spectators of the scene, at Fox, who alternately licked the hand of Madame Marbeuf and of Cecil, and at Augustus, whose confusion was gradually disappearing. Madame Marbeuf repeated,
"Come kiss me, my dear child." "Did you know, madame, that I was your nephew?" said Cecil, complying with her invitation. As his head rested on her bosom, he felt her tears fall on his cheek.
"No, she did not know it until today," said Mr. Raymond. "As I entered her house this morning, I met you and this young man, who you told me was your cousin. I was going to question you when your cousin drew you away. I made some inquiries of Madame Marbeuf, and she told me that she had not seen the child, but that the young man was her nephew, whom she disowned, because he had ill-treated a little cousin who had suddenly disappeared. This disappearance, the title of the cousin, which you gave to the young man, the relation who had wronged you, and whose name you would never mention, awakened my suspicions. Before I made up my mind what to do, your cousin himself entered. Madame, he said to Madame Marbeuf, pardon me for daring to present myself before you again. I am a miserable wretch. I neither deserve mercy nor compassion, and, when I tell you that the nephew whom you seek is the boy who brought your dog, you will, perhaps, make your servants kick me out of the house, but I will not complain. He then gave the address of the printing office where you were employed. A servant was dispatched for you, but you had gone out for the whole day. We were determined to give you an agreeable surprise at your own house, but Madame Marbeuf wished to see the blind man, whose history I related to her. Next we went to your friend the invalid, and desired him to accompany us, and here we have all been waiting for the arrival of our host for at least 2 hours.
Augustus, said Cecil affectionately, you will not envy my happiness any more, I am sure.
No, because you deserve it, replied Augustus, with unwonted softness.
And if I have reason to rejoice, so have you, added Cecil gaily. If I have recovered an aunt, you have found one likewise.
There you deceive yourself, Cecil, replied Madame Marbeuf. I will not acknowledge him as my nephew.
Oh, aunt, began Cecil supplicatingly.
It is useless to talk to me, said his aunt. He knows it. I have not deceived him. And I told him that whether he found you or not, my fortune was forever lost to him.
No matter your fortune, but your affection, aunt, said Cecil. Your affection, that may be his?
It appears, said Mr. Raymond, laughing, that you are more willing to share your aunt's heart with your cousin than her fortune.
Cecil replied without coloring, as the satire of the remark had escaped him.
That is because, after what I have learned, I understand that I can do what I please with my aunt's fortune, so Augustus will share it with me. But with her affections, it is very different.
There is too much goodness in this child, madame, said Mr. Raymond, for it to be possible that his cousin should be totally deficient. Does not the same blood flow through their veins? Come, madame, forgive him. It is your husband's old friend who entreats you.
I can never take back what I have once said, replied Madame Marbeuf.
It is not just that the wicked should be recompensed as well as the good.
All that I can promise is that I will not interfere with what Cecil chooses to do for his cousin. I will permit him to be as generous as he desires to be. He may give Augustus money, if he chooses, but it must be in his own name. And you will receive him sometimes at your house, will you not? Asked Mr. Raymond. Madame Marbouf replied coldly, Cecil will always have a right to offer his cousin a seat at my table or a bed in my house.
Be content, then. You will not want for anything, whispered Cecil in the ear of Augustus. Cecil had hardly finished his whisper when he felt a dog's little teeth biting on his hand. It was Fox, who appeared to reproach his master for having forgotten him.
Oh, you are right, Fox, you are right, said Cecil, bending down and embracing him.
I am very ungrateful. You have given me everything. Without you, I should still be the poor little Robinson Crusoe, and you my man Friday.
It only remains to be told that Cecil finished his studies at one of the first colleges in Paris, and instead of the little cottage on Mr. Raymond's ground stands a handsome house, in the building of which Paul and his comrades assisted. The old invalid, to whom Cecil presented another Austerlitz, was placed as a guard during its construction, and the place of the doorkeeper is given to the blind man and his family. Cecil himself is the owner of the house. As for Augustus, notwithstanding the care and attention of Cecil, whose kindness did not decrease, and notwithstanding his aunt's condescension in allowing him a seat at her table, he enlisted as a soldier not long since, and went to Africa. Fox is yet alive, and has grown quite fat, which does not prevent his standing on his hind legs and dancing, rather heavily to be sure, when his young master cries out,
Come, Fox, my man Friday, come and dance for your little Robinson of Paris.
End of chapter 36. End of The Little Robinson of Paris, or Industry's Triumph, by Eugenie Foa, translated by Lucy Landon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.